the trader and often result in missed winning trade opportunities. As Platt colorfully describes the trader's mindset after incurring a foolish loss, you feel like an idiot and you're not in the mood to put anything else on. Then the elephant walks past you while your gun's not loaded. Platt says that trading follows the 80-20 rule. 80% of a trader's profits come from 20% of the trades. If the psychological fallout from a trading loss causes a trader to miss a trade in the 20%, it can be a big deal. Platt pays a lot of attention to how the market responds to news. He cites the interesting observation of a trade in which there was a continuing stream of news items adverse to his position, and yet the market did not move against him. Platt read the inability of the market to respond to the news as confirmation of his trade idea, and he quadrupled his position, turning it into one of his biggest winners ever. Although Bluecrest's systematic trend-following strategy is not in the same return-slash-risk league as the discretionary strategy, it is nonetheless one of the best-performing trend-following strategies, achieving an average annual compounded net return of 16% with a maximum drawdown of under 13%. When queried about how the systematic trend-following strategy achieved its superior performance vis-a-vis other trend-following strategies, Platt mentioned two key factors. First, their system will liquidate positions when trends get overextended without waiting for trend reversal signals. Second, there is continuous ongoing research and implementation of changes to improve the system. System trading is a dynamic rather than static process. Platt believes that systems that don't change will eventually degrade. In Platt's words, system trading is a research war. Part 3. Equity. Chapter 9. Steve Clark. Do more of what works and less of what doesn't. Steve Clark's fund, the Omni Global Fund, has achieved remarkable performance consistency. The strategy has been profitable in every year since its inception 10.5 years ago, 2001. The worst year was a 0.7% gain in 2011. Omni's 19.4% average annual compounded return is impressive, but what truly sets Omni apart is that it achieved these strong returns while containing the worst peak-to-valley equity drawdown to a modest 7%. The fund's Sharpe ratio is an extremely high 1.50. The Sharpe ratio, however, which makes no distinction between upside and downside volatility, understates the fund's performance because volatility has been heavily skewed to the upside. There have been many months with gains above 4% and some much higher, but only 2 months with losses above this level, both less than 5%. As a result of the combination of strong gains and moderate losses, the fund has an extremely high gain-to-pain ratio of 4.1. In 2008, an absolutely disastrous year for event-driven hedge funds, the Hedge Fund Research, HFR, index for this sector was down 22% for the year. Omni was actually up 15%. Warren Buffett has said that it's only when the tide goes out that you discover who's been swimming naked. 2008 made clear that Omni was swimming fully clothed in multiple layers. Steve Clark was brutally honest, probably more so than any other trader I have ever interviewed. He seemed to hold nothing back, whether it was about his past experiences or his feelings. His emotions at times were palpable. His directness made this an unexpectedly compelling interview for me. Clark began our conversation by telling the story from the time he finished school at the age of 17. I did my A-levels a year early and left school at the age of 17. I knew nothing about university. No one in my family had been to university.
You came from a working-class background?
I was the third generation, all living in the same council house. Government housing is what I guess you would call in the U.S., on the outskirts of London. I didn't know my father, and he didn't hang around. I lived with my mother, brother, and grandparents. My mother was always working, so I was sort of half-raised by my grandparents. One day I got a call from Grant, a school friend who now works here, a call for which I am eternally grateful. He was considered one of the posh kids at school because his parents actually owned their house. You should come and work in the city, Grant said. There are 25-year-olds earning £50,000. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I thought I would go there and earn some money until I decided what I wanted to be when I grew up. I'm still waiting. I naively thought, okay, I will go to work in the city then and be a trader. I didn't even know what a trader was.
Was Grant working as a trader?
He was working as a trading assistant. I had no concept what that meant either.
What were you doing at the time?
I was working for a hi-fi installation company. I was designing the layout of home stereo system installations, lifting things, and driving a van.
Did you try to get a job in the city?
I wrote lots and lots of places and always got the same answer. No degree, no interview, or no experience, no interview.
That is exactly what I would have expected.
I did get one interview for a back office job at Manufacturers Hanover. I had a terrible interview. I talked about how I wanted to be a trader, with absolutely no thought given to the fact that the fellow interviewing me wanted somebody to work in the back office. Needless to say, I didn't get the job, but I learned from that interview process. I realized that the sensible thing to do was to get some experience. At the time, this was 1986, there was a shortage of back office people. I got a job as a temporary filing clerk and then moved to different temporary jobs, each time embroidering my CV. Anytime I was offered a position and asked if I could do it, I said that I could. I figured that I could learn how to do it once I was at the job. I did that for several months, and then I got two permanent job offers. One was from Merrill Lynch to run part of the back office, which paid £30,000, and the other was from Warburg Securities to be a blue button.
What is a blue button?
On the stock exchange floor, you had badges with your firm written on it and a number. The color of your badge indicated your role. Blue buttons were boys who were trainees, but who in reality were treated as slaves. The blue button job paid £7,000, so it was £30,000 on the left hand versus £7,000 on the right hand, but the £7,000 job got you on the trading floor. I thought that was clearly the place I needed to be. I still remember my interview for the job. The guy asked me about what relevant experience I had. I certainly knew nothing. I didn't read the Financial Times, and I didn't pretend to read the Financial Times. The only clever answer I gave was when he asked me whether I ever gambled. I asked, "Do you mean like gambling on the horses?" He answered, "Yes, exactly." I replied, "I would never bet on anything where the odds were against me. Why would you do that?" I didn't know whether that was the right answer or the wrong answer, but it was my instinctive answer. I got the job. I started on South African gold shares, and literally my job was to get tea, coffee, sandwiches, book trades, and answer the phone. I really had a miserable time on the first desk I was on. I couldn't understand what was going on, and no one was willing to answer a question or teach me anything. It was a very poor experience. But I was a very good blue button. I was very good at doing the P&Ls. I got transferred to the European desk, where the people had a completely different attitude. They were very happy to talk to me and to teach me.
At what point were you allowed to trade?
After I was there for about 1 year, I was given the Scandinavian market-making book. I was going to run the book for 1 week because the trader was on holiday. This first week that I was given a book to run on my own was the week of the October 1987 crash.
So literally, October 19th, 1987 was the first day you were allowed to trade?
Yes.
That has to be the most interesting trading start date I have ever heard, or I'm sure that I will ever hear. At least you had no positions coming in.
Oh, no, I took over the book.
And your boss was incommunicado?
He was on holiday. The previous week we had been told that we would be receiving a large institutional buy order for a basket of stocks. The trader I worked for had bought those stocks in anticipation of buying support. So I came in Monday morning long only. The most vivid memory I have of the day is making a price in a stock called Electrolux. I get a call asking for a price on Electrolux. I say they are 43 bid, 44 offered. He offers 10,000 shares at 43. I buy 2,500 shares and put the phone down. I then change my price to 42.5 bid, 43.5 offered. The phone rings again, and I give the caller my new quote. He offers 10,000 shares, and I buy 2,500 at 42.5. I reason that if I drop my price by a full dollar to 41.5, 42.5, and I get hit on the offer, I would be selling my shares at a loss. This is how I was thinking on the morning of the crash. So I set the price at 42.43. The phone rings, and once again I get a hit with an offer, so I bought another 2,500 shares at 42. At this point, I turn around to the German trader, who, unlike me, had lots of experience, and show him my trades and say, "I've done these trades, what price should I make now?" He looks at me like I am a complete imbecile. Meanwhile, the phone is ringing. He picks up the phone. I was going to make the next price 41.5, 42.5. He makes the price 36, 37, and still gets hit with an offer at 36. so I had been making the totally wrong prices. I had no clue to what was going on, but I learned a very valuable lesson from that experience. The price is where anyone is prepared to deal, and it can be anything. I had 1 year of experience, and I had seen only a limited amount of volatility. In my mind, I couldn't comprehend changing the price by more than $1, let alone $6, which is nearly a 15% change. I had never witnessed that before. Actually, not many people had ever seen anything similar before.
Where was the market price? You weren't determining the market price, were you?
Oh, I was determining the price. All the systems were down, so I was getting calls from people asking me the price.
Weren't other people making a market in the stock?
There were other market makers, but you couldn't see their prices.
So the German trader understood the market was falling out of bed.
After he looked at my trades, he told me, "Your position is growing. You cannot afford to let your next trade be a purchase. Whatever you have to do, you need to make sure that your next trade is a sell." He quoted the price down by $6 and still ended up buying.
What about the long inventory you came in with at the start of the day?
You couldn't do anything that day. You just had to ride the whole thing down.
What about people who called wanting to sell? As a market maker, did you have to facilitate the trade?
You just quoted the prices down to a point where you didn't buy anymore.
So after those initial trades at the wrong price, you didn't do much at all. I guess you just quoted prices down far enough to make sure you wouldn't get any more sell orders.
That is exactly right. My book, the book I had taken over for the week, lost several million pounds that day. The German trader was short everything, so he made several million pounds.
He sounds like a smart fellow.
He was a smart guy. Years later, I employed him. Actually, years later, I also employed the trader who ran the Scandinavian book, who was my boss. From that point on, I began to trade other books in the European area, where people were on holiday. I eventually became the most profitable trader in the group.
How? What were you doing that made you so profitable?
I was very proactive in orientating the book. If I was in something that was wrong, I would cut it. I wouldn't defend it. I wouldn't average down. I would just cut it, cut it, cut it.
What does being proactive mean for a market maker?
I was very active in positioning myself. I would trade around news, trying to orient myself on the right side of market. I would develop my own views on stocks and be happy to run with those views. Also, I was so inexperienced that I didn't have the fear that cripples people who have been in the business too long. I have seen that so many times. Very few people maintain their ability to take risk throughout their career. Most don't. Most can't. They have had too many bad things happen to them, too many fat tails, and it damages people.
Not having fear and cutting positions when they are going against you speaks to a willingness to take a risk and an ability to control risk. But to make money, you still have to be on the right side of the market, which raises the question, how are you calling the directional moves to have some sort of an edge?
You have to go back to the facts. What do you know? If you know there is a buyer for XYZ stock at some price below the market, you know one fact. You know there is a buyer there. What else do you know? Go back and see what happened the last time the market got to this level. You can look at the chart. I also used volume as a screen for what stocks I should be looking at. My thought process would be, there is lots of volume, something is going on. Can I develop a view from that?
How important were charts to your trading?
Charts are simply a record of how things have traded in the past. That's it. I'm not a big believer in chart analysis. It is extremely appealing to think that you can take a data set from the past and predict what will happen in the future. It is very attractive because as a human being, you are always looking for certainty. You can use charts to give you a plus or a minus towards your view, but you can never start with a chart. To say that you can predict the future from past data is patently untrue. You can talk about percentage probabilities of what might happen next, but you can't go any further than that. So I would combine the charts with other facts, such as what I knew about where the orders were and the market volume.
How long were you a market maker for Warburg Securities?
I stayed for 2.5 years. I left because I was only being paid 13,000 pounds per year, and I was clearly the best trader they had in that area. Lehman Brothers offered me a job for 50,000 pounds per year. I went back to Warburg and told him that I was leaving because I had a much better offer.
They said, "We can put you at 28,000 pounds. I said, why 28,000 pounds? Why not 50,000 pounds? Well, they said, we have all these tiers and you are a trainee. I thought that was total bullshit. They could do whatever they wanted, so I went to Lehman Brothers. Here's where it gets interesting. Warburg was number one rated. I came from a place where you were imbued with the feeling that you were the best. I went to Lehman Brothers, and I couldn't make a penny. Why is that? Because I had no idea how to make money outside of the Warburg environment, which was so rich in order flow information. So, going back to the question I originally asked you, was the edge then coming from knowledge of where the orders were? The opportunity to make money was there because of the franchise, but the fact that I was making multiples of the people around me indicated that I was doing something better than they were. You were using that order flow information better. But it must be very helpful to know that there are a lot of buy orders below the market, and if you are long and wrong, the stock should run into buying support, and you shouldn't get hurt much. Yes, it's a nice, comfortable place to be. But if you have no idea where the orders are, it's not quite so easy. Was that a revelation? Oh, totally. I was so happy at Warburg. I loved going to work. I didn't want to leave, but I thought I had to. I've always been driven to be rational. 50,000 pounds versus 28,000 pounds, I had to go. The decision was so clear. So I went to Lehman, and I couldn't make any money. It was a terrible shock to my ego. I began to doubt my ability. It was a very depressing time. It lasted for several months. I've seen this happen to many traders, and I have gone through it several times myself. When you find that you can't make any money, smaller and smaller losses take on greater and greater emotional significance, and you lose all perspective. I can remember this incident very clearly. I was playing basketball one night, and I got a call from our New York office to tell me that there had been a big move in Novo, a Danish company, which was one of the European stocks I covered. It was up $2 from the European close. I asked if the stock was bid. He said there was 100,000 shares bid. As a gut reaction, I went short the entire amount. It was the biggest position I had taken by a mile. But since you were so gun-shy, why would you take on a position that large? I reverted to my old Warburg mode when my brain would have calculated the risk and just done the trade. Why did you think it was a good risk? It was up $2 from the close, which was a big move for a stock that didn't move that much. It was just a gut reaction. I came in the next morning and bought the stock back for a $100,000 turn. From that moment on, I couldn't stop making money. I guess because you got your confidence back. But you still had no order flow to work against, so where was your edge? I developed very strong relationships with other brokers, so I used their order flow information. I was also trading news flow. What would determine if you were a buyer or seller after a news item hit? It was a matter of sampling views of brokers that I trusted. I've always thought that when you are trading over a short to medium term, your own views on the fundamentals of a story are totally irrelevant. What you have to do is gauge what the market thinks of the story. I would sample opinions, and if there were enough people saying that we were going to see buying on the back of the news item, I would go long. If I didn't see momentum develop, I would cut it, and if I did see upward momentum, I might increase the position size. I am a big believer in buying on the way up. So you were speaking to people who you thought were more right than wrong? Yes, and they had order flow. That was one element of my trading. I also started to screen for volume. I thought that my trading was good enough so that if I could find volume or a story, I could trade it. I was trading successfully, and then I read your book, Market Wizards. It was a seminal moment in my trading career. I was reading about people in your book and thinking, that is what I do. That is one of my rules. It was like these people had copied what I do. How could they know? It was an awakening because for the first time in my life, I realized that I had a method. Up until that point, I thought I was playing a video game, and I couldn't believe I was getting paid to do it. I enjoyed it so much that I would have done it for nothing. The one thing that I really took away from your book was that once you understand you have a method, you can tweak that method. Time and time again, I give traders who work for me one piece of advice. Do more of what works and less of what doesn't. Young traders come to me and say, well, I've been running this book and these things have been going really well, but I keep losing money on this. I tell them to just stop doing the things that are not working. Dissect your P&L and see what works for you and what doesn't. It is a very interesting process to analyze where your profits come from, and traders often don't know. How did that advice apply to you at the time?
I decided to look at what I did as a trader. Where did I make money? That was the point at which I started to move to event-driven trading.
Where were you making money?
I had a series of trades where I had an edge. They were arbitrages. So I started looking for more arbitrage trades.
You were doing best in arbitrage trades, so you focused on arbitrage. Where were you not doing well?
I wasn't doing badly anywhere, but the arbitrage trades were by far the most consistent and profitable. There was really only one trade at the time where I took a big loss, and it was strictly hubris. The stock was 1912 DS, a Danish shipping company, which traded at an extremely high share price of 140,000 Danish kroner. It traded in lots of one share or five shares. For some reason, I had become bullish on the stock and bought a lot of it. Then there was an article in the paper that said the company was a fraud. I had bought the stock at 140,000. It opened the next day at 100,000 offered and nothing bid. I remember the sick feeling in my stomach that morning. I worked out what the loss was at a price of 100,000 and thought, that's too big, I can't show that today. So what I did was write down the price of that stock a little bit every day for the next 3 months, while I traded as hard as I could to make money.
So the stock didn't trade.
There were literally no trades for a long time, there were no bids.
Wasn't there a settlement price anywhere?
No, this was the Wild West. Traders marked their own book. No one checked it. Smoothing losses was the status quo.
How much was the ultimate loss?
I don't remember exactly, but I sold it somewhere higher than 100,000.
So the company wasn't a fraud then?
No, the article turned out to be total nonsense. That trade taught me a very valuable lesson. Price is irrelevant. It is size that kills you. If you are too big in an illiquid stock, there is no way out. I wanted to cut the position, but I couldn't. The other lesson this trade taught me is to focus on what works. The trade was just a punt. I bought it because I thought the momentum would carry it up. After that trade, I became much more focused on just looking for arbitrage trades, which was where I was making most of my money.
How did you make a transition from a market maker role to a hedge fund manager?
After Lehman, I switched to NatWest. It was the same job, but a much bigger business. I was hired to run market making for international shares. After 3 years there, I got bored, and I also wanted to make more money. I told them that I was leaving to set up a hedge fund. I really had no concept of what setting up a hedge fund involved, but I figured whatever it was, I could do it. They told me if I left then, I wouldn't get my bonus. But I didn't care. I found a hedge fund manager who said he would seed me with $5 million. I then spent several months getting the hedge fund set up. By the time I was done and ready to go, he wouldn't return my phone calls. He had been annihilated by the bond market in 1994 and had lost most of his assets. He clearly wasn't going to speak to me, so I had a hedge fund with no assets.
Didn't you think about where you would raise the money before you decided to leave NatWest to start a hedge fund?
No.
You just figured you would open a hedge fund and money would come.
That absolutely was my attitude. When I decided to go work in the city, I had no idea what that meant, but I resolved that I would just go and do it. How hard could it be? I figured it couldn't be that hard, and ultimately it wasn't that hard. It was the same with starting a hedge fund. I just figured I would do it. It never occurred to me I wouldn't be able to raise any money. I didn't think I needed a lot of money because I had no concept of leverage. I knew I could get 10 times leverage, so if I wanted to trade a $50 million book, all I would need would be $5 million. It didn't occur to me that people wouldn't want you running money at 10 times leverage. I really was completely naive about the whole thing. I just did it. I set up a hedge fund with no money. I had $300,000 of my own cash in the fund, and that was it.
What was the name of your hedge fund?
It was LS Asset Management.
What did the LS stand for?
Now there is an interesting tale. We had a nickname at the time for people who threw money around, Larry Shag.
Larry Shag?
It was a market term for a bit of a player, someone brash, exactly the wrong image you would want to give investors if you're asking to manage their money. It worked well, though, because I could always tell people the LS stood for long short.
Sort of like someone who is a shooter.
Yes. We'll have a go at this, we'll have a go at that.
Were you able to start trading the fund with just your own $300,000?
Yes, but it meant that every trade I did would have to be for $300,000. I couldn't trade any smaller. I ran the hedge fund out of my kitchen. Morgan Stanley gave me a prime brokerage account for which I am forever grateful. It was one of the best and worst experiences in business I have ever had.
Sounds a bit Dickensian.
It was a fantastic learning experience, but I would have much preferred to read about it. Emotionally, the highs got lower and the lows became incredibly low.
Specifically, what happened?
Let me give you the story of the first day.
You are really one for memorable first days.
On my first day, I did my first trade, and I made £37,000, or about $60,000, on my $300,000 cash. I walked out of the kitchen and said to my wife at the time, "I just made £37,000. It is going to be a success. I don't have to worry about the seed capital. If I can keep compounding like this, we'll be in great shape." She said, "That is really good, but garbage collection is happening in 10 minutes. If you don't get the bins down to the bottom of the drive in time, we're going to miss it and we'll have all the garbage in the garden for the next week." I remember literally answering, "But I am a master of the universe." She said, "Yes, and you now have 8 minutes to get the rubbish down to the bottom of the driveway." I remember walking down the garden, carrying the garbage bags, and muttering to myself, "I am a fucking master of the fucking universe. I just made fucking £37,000, and I am carrying the fucking rubbish out." That was the high point of my experience the first time I read a hedge fund. That was as good as it ever got.
What went wrong?
After that, I made some money and lost some money, and then, I don't know if I should go into this.
Don't worry, we can always take it out if it's a problem.
I worked very closely with a guy when I was at NatWest, and he really stitched me. He strongly recommended that I buy a stock, which I did buy. The next day, the stock had a big loss. I waited for a phone call from him, but it never came. Eventually, I called him and asked him what was going on with the stock he had recommended. He said he had been selling the stock all day. He just stitched me.
That was a bad experience. What do you mean he stitched you?
He recommended buying the stock, which I did. The next day, he smashed the stock.
When you say stitched you, you mean he set you up?
Yes, I thought he was a friend, but he wasn't a friend. Some people who you work with for years and think will support you will do nothing to help you, while other people you know in passing may be very helpful. It really taught me a lot about human nature and made me think again about whom you can and can't trust.
How much did you lose on that stock tip? Did you lose as much as you made on the big trade on the first day?
I lost more than that. The fund had been running a few months, and I was going to show a 10% loss as of the end of the month. There was a total disconnect between my feelings and reality. In my head, if I was down 10%, my business would be over. No one would ever give me money to manage. I had no perspective. I had no older person to put his hand on my shoulder and say, "Calm down, just do the things that work and stop doing the things that don't." I can remember sitting at the kitchen table, my head in my hands, staring into an abyss. I put so much pressure on myself to make money every day. I must make money. I must make money. I must make money. And I was having a very hard time making money in the market. It felt like the market was kicking me around. I woke up one morning around 4 a.m., lying in bed, feeling sick in my stomach, and thinking, "What is the market going to do to me today?" I closed the business that day. It was an incredibly tough experience. If only I had had someone give me perspective and say, "Slow down. You're not trying to make 500%. Stop thinking in absolute terms and start thinking in terms of percentages."
What did you do after you closed your fund?
I went to Nomura, where I started a risk arbitrage business.
What was your approach to risk arbitrage?
Do fewer deals and be bigger. If you have a big enough balance sheet, buy enough shares to be sure you have enough votes. If you thought you needed 8% of shares to assure the approval of the merger plan, you might as well buy 15% because you knew the deal would be going through. Just be big. That was a very successful approach.
But you still have other risks in the deal going through, like failure to get government approval.
I would tend to be big late in the deal when those other risks had been ticked off. All we were ever concerned about was the likelihood of the deal closing. The spread margins were secondary. Parents buying out subsidiaries were by far the best trade. There were no due diligence issues, and you knew the deal would be going through. Nomura ended badly for me because there was a change in management. The new guy in charge wasn't straight. He had a convertible book, and all he was doing was buying illiquid convertible bonds and every month and pushing the price up. He was the market because he owned most of these issues. so all he had to do was buy a few hundred bonds every month to push the price up. At one point, a trader from another department came to me for guidance because he was being asked to mismark the book.
Was he a subordinate?
He was subordinate to one of the other managers.
Why did he come to you?
Because I had a reputation for being straight. I told him to mark the book correctly and I would deal with it. I went to the senior management and said they couldn't put pressure on this guy to mismark his book. He was a lowly trader. If it ever came out, it could ruin his career. I told them they had to leave the book marked correctly. I thought it was a cogent argument. A week later, I was asked to leave because I was not a team player. I told them if they wanted to fire me, that was fine, but they needed to pay me the percentage I was owed. They wanted me to resign first, and then they would pay me afterwards. I asked them, do I have the word stupid written across my forehead? I had two follow-up meetings with management. I didn't trust them, so I went to the meetings with a hidden tape recorder. Eventually, they fired me, and I sued them. It took 3 years for the case to go to trial, and it cost me £350,000 in legal expenses. If I had lost the case, it would have financially wiped me out. We went to court and won the case hands down.
Did you use your recordings in the trial?
Oh, yes, and they were extremely useful. We furnished Nomura with the tape transcripts, but they still weren't prepared. At one point in the trial, one of their witnesses testified regarding to some conversation. The judge said, there is a transcript, show me where he said that. He answered, it's not there. The judge said, I'll cross out that section of your statement. What about the next section? Would you like me to cross that out as well? The tape really helped me in terms of credibility because I had told the absolute truth while they had lied. I got £1.35 million, which was equal to 15% of my profits. It should have been 20%. When I look back, even though I won the case, it was a bad decision to sue.
Why is that?
If I had spent the time it took for the litigation to drag out pursuing my own business, I would have made multiples of the £1.35 million settlement. It was a bad trade.
What did you do in those intervening years?
I literally built a house. I dug my own foundation. I did most of the work myself. I hired a builder to help with the things I couldn't do on my own.
What else occupied you during those 3 years besides building your own house?
I had my court case, and I was building a house. That occupied all my time.
Did you have any plans about what you were eventually going to do?
I didn't know what I was going to do, but I was finished with markets in the city. I was never going back.
Why? You had done very well in the markets.
Because I had such a terrible experience with people. The company politics, people lying. In my view, all I had ever done for any of my employers was make money. And yet I didn't have much money. Either I didn't get paid properly, or even when I had a contract, I got screwed on that. I found the whole experience to be very discouraging.
How do you go from loving the markets, like it was a video game you were being paid to play, to not even wanting to get a trading job?
That's an interesting question, isn't it? In 1986, I had gone to the city to make some money until I figured out what I wanted to do. I never worked it out. I still haven't worked it out.
Apparently, at some point, you did get back into the markets. How did that occur?
It was a bit of coincidence. I was going on a fishing trip in Venezuela with an old buddy from NatWest. I traveled via New York, and while I was there, I spoke to an old broker contact who advised me to speak to First New York Securities. I met with the two guys who had set up the business. Both of them at the time were in their 60s. They wanted me to come to work for First New York Securities for a fixed percentage of the profits I made. Initially, I was reluctant because of all the negative experiences I had, but eventually they convinced me to come to New York for a few months to give it a try. After I had been there for a few months, the guy in charge said to me, "We've been talking about you. We decided you were a player." I'm thinking, here it comes. I'm going to get screwed now. He continued, "We owe you a lot of money, but you have never mentioned it." I said, "If I thought I needed a contract, I wouldn't be here. If you're telling me that I need one, I'll just go now and you can just keep the money." Then in my poor attempt at humor, I said, "And I'm sure that if I fell under a bus, you would give money to my kids." Later that day, two partners independently approached me with the same basic assurance. One of them said, "I want to assure you that if anything ever happened to you, I would personally make sure your family got the money."
Clark is visibly moved by this recollection. You sound emotional about it, even to this day.
I'm still getting emotional about it now because it was the first time that anyone had said anything like that to me. It really, really touched me.
What did they mean when they called you a player?
because they owed me money and I hadn't been asking where my money was. Since I hadn't mentioned it, they brought it up.
What kind of trading were you doing?
I was doing directional risk arbitrage.
What does that mean?
I might do the risk arbitrage, or I might not hedge, or I might go long both sides. It depended on the situation. I was basically trading the companies in a merger event.
When did you start your current fund, and what happened to your relationship with First New York Securities?
I set up my own asset management business in the UK and started an event-driven fund in 2001. I continue to manage First New York Securities money pari passu alongside with the fund, and I still do. I was also a de facto advisor to First New York Securities, but with my fund having grown to near $1 billion, I didn't want to maintain that commitment. I met with the head of the firm in New York, and I told him I was too busy with my own fund to maintain my advisory role with First New York Securities. I said, I will leave you with one bit of parting advice. You are too old. You're killing your own business. Get out. He said, I think you are right.
How did you think he was killing the business?
Like any entrepreneur who starts a business, he was holding on too tight. They had been doing proprietary trading for 25 years and had never had a losing year. Despite that track record, they have missed the entire growth in asset management. They have had no hedge fund business through the entire hedge fund era. He was getting too old to take risks, and he admitted it himself. In the end, I agreed to become a managing member of First New York Securities. The firm is very inefficiently run and has no technology. We need to make it more efficient and bring it into the 21st century. We need to start managing outside money and create a more valuable business. That is the plan.
What are your long-term goals?
I am still waiting to figure out what it is I want to do when I grow up. I am still waiting for the revelation. In some ways, it is quite depressing.
I don't understand. You have been very successful.
But what have I achieved? I haven't built anything.
How do you measure success? If it's monetary, by any reasonable definition, you have been more than successful. If it is building a business, again by reasonable definition, you have been successful. You are not going to invent a cure for cancer. If you want to impact the world, I guess you could give money away.
I give money away, that's what I do. I'm still here because I couldn't figure out anything better to do at the time. It still feels like I'm waiting to work out what I should be doing.
Don't you feel that trading is what you were born to do?
Well, no. I have a view, and maybe it's a bit egotistical, that I can do anything I want to do.
I'll go to the city to get a job as a trader. I will build a house. I'll take on a bank in litigation. I'll start a hedge fund. If that's your perspective, then do whatever you want to do.
That's the problem.
You don't know what you want to do.
No, but I can tell you that running a fund doesn't make me happy. I enjoy it, but I used to enjoy it a lot more than I do now.
Why is that?
Because it was a lot less complicated. I was just trading. Now it's running a business.
You're still searching for something.
Yes, there is still a hole there. I'm searching to be satisfied by something. Let me tell you the trouble with trading. There is no career in trading. You are only as good as your last trade, and that is it. You build nothing, you just trade. The day you stop trading, it's gone. So what you have spent doing for X hours every working day of your life has ended, and there's nothing left to show for it except for money. You have to keep trading because you don't want to stop and look back. Because what have you done? You have built nothing. You have achieved nothing. You get to the end of it and look back and wonder, what have I accomplished? I have a very nihilistic view of it, but that is the way I feel. I'm still back at that point when I'm a 17-year-old trying to decide what I want to do.
But somewhere along the line you went from having joy in this business to feeling unsatisfied. Do you know what caused that transition?
I'm not sure, but it is probably from the point that I decided I was going to grow a business instead of just trading.
That almost sounds like it was when you started the hedge fund.
It probably was. The joy ended. Being a trader was fun and you could walk away. But when you have a business, you can't walk away. So it becomes a prison in some ways, whereas being a trader was very free.
Ironically, you've taken on more business responsibility by becoming a managing member of First New York Securities. Where is the rationale in that?
The rationale is that there is a trade to be done.
The trade is to fix the company?
Yes, the trade is to fix the company, be involved for a period, and get much more value for it. It's all very rational.
I try to do rational things. Sometimes you make rational decisions every step of the way and yet end up in a place that is very far from where you want to be. When I first came to New York Securities, I said, I don't want to manage anything, I just want to trade. And here we are.
It's very ironic. You said you didn't want to manage anything, and you ended up helping manage the company.
Yes, it is. I also constantly think that I am about to be found out, which is another personal driver.
What do you mean by found out?
A number of times in my career, I have thought that maybe I've just been lucky. Maybe I don't really know what I'm doing, and I have just bluffed my way through. Maybe I have just found a few trades that work, but I won't find any more trades that work, and I will be found out.
I had overrun my meeting time allotment, and Clark had to leave for another meeting. We decided that we would finish the interview on one of his trips to New York. Several months later, I met with Clark at First New York Securities. After some casual conversation, he began talking about trading before I even asked a question.
As a trader, you have to be honest with yourself. I have met many traders who have laid out a strategy on how they will be scale-down buyers. I'll buy some at 8, and if it goes down, I will add 7, 6, and 5. But if you are the type of person who will be puking his guts out if it goes to 7, let alone to 6 or lower, you shouldn't be buying at all at 8, or if you do, it should be 25% of the size. You have to train yourself to trade at a smaller size so that you trade within your emotional capacity. If you are really, really excited about a trade and swing the bat in a big way, and 10 minutes later the market moves against you, but you are the type of person who doesn't handle that type of volatility well, you will end up cutting your position and losing money, even if the trade was ultimately a big winner. We see this behavior in traders all the time. It is the size of the position you put on rather than the price which you put it on that determines your ability to keep the position.
Your message, then, is that although traders focus almost entirely on where to enter a trade, in reality, the entry size is more important than the entry price, because if the size is right, you are much more likely to stay with a winning trade.
One of the first lessons my first boss taught me was that price is irrelevant. It is all about controlling the size of your position. On a related point, liquidity is also very important. That is why when a merger deal breaks, we cut it straight away because you get a pocket of liquidity. It may be at a much lower level, but at least you have the liquidity. If you wait, the liquidity can dry up, and you will be left with an outsized position in what has become a directional trade.
Getting the size of a position wrong is a perfect example of a common trader mistake. What other mistakes have you seen traders typically make in the course of your career?
One of the things we have seen inside First New York Securities many times is traders coming from an information-rich environment, such as a big investment bank, to a trading house and finding that the information flow is all gone. It is like trading in a vacuum for them. We have seen guys with incredibly strong reputations who have been trading actively for years in big size, and when they come here, they find they can't make any money, and maybe they even lose a little bit. It becomes a downward spiral. They trade smaller and smaller, and every dollar they lose becomes emotionally more and more important to them. They lose all perspective. Many of these traders never had a plan. They just responded to the stimuli around them. I tell them that they need to replace the information flow they previously had. I advise them to draw up a list of 20 contacts and phone them every day.
Does that work?
Well, they don't take the advice.
What other advice do you give them?
I have been through similar situations myself. I found it was critical to find things to involve yourself in. It is a very good thing to be busy when you are a prop trader because you don't want to have too much time to stare at the screen, particularly if your style of trading is to have only a limited number of positions on at one time. Once you have your positions on and are waiting for the market to do what it needs to do, what are you going to do in the interim? Coming back again to the investment bank world, they have meetings and all sorts of stuff going on that suck-up time. Traders would all complain about the waste of time, but what it actually meant was that it limited the amount of time they were in front of their screen staring at their positions. You don't want to be sitting in front of your screen and staring at market prices for 12 hours a day. Staring at the price is not going to tell you very much. You will start to overprocess and overtrade.
I have found that one of the common denominators among successful traders is patience, particularly in regards to staying with good trades long enough. And that is true regardless of the time frame, even day traders. I assume the more time you spend staring at the screen, the less patience you will have.
You will have less patience, and if you are in a negative loop, every downtick cuts you.
you will feel physical pain with every tick the market goes against you.
It sounds like you have had that experience.
I've had several occasions in my career where I sat with my head in my hands thinking, I am never going to make a penny again. I am crap. I have always been crap. I have just been found out.
Even though you have made money for 10 years, you can still get into that mindset. You had a knack for trading, but now it is gone. You lost it.
I lost it. I was never that good. It was just the market. Now the market has changed, and I don't know what to do. It's a horrible, horrible feeling.
When you do get into that type of phase, what do you do?
I have learned over the years that when you get into that mode, don't do anything. Discipline yourself to not trade for 2 weeks or whatever time period you choose. Take a holiday.
Does that work?
Oh, yeah, as long as you don't have any positions on when you go. You need to get out of everything. Then go away and forget about it.
Now, that takes time because what you will do for the first few days is torture yourself. I could have done this. I could have done that. But for me, after a few days, I can let it go. Once you let go, you can unwind. Then when you come back, you have to set rules. You need to be able to say that you won't trade for, say, 2 weeks. You'll see trades that you are itching to do, but you need to have all the discipline not to do them because clearly you are not in sync with the markets. Otherwise, you wouldn't be where you are. When you feel you are ready to begin trading and see a trade that you really like, trade a fraction of the size you would normally trade. At least half the time, the trade may go your way initially, but then it will go against you because all you may be experiencing is a feel for the next few ticks.
At this point, the president of First New York Securities ushers in my son, who works at the firm, saying, I wanted to introduce a young man to you. I had arrived at just the last minute for my scheduled meeting with Clark, so I did not get a chance to say hello to my son first. We all chat for a few minutes, and they leave. Clark queries me a bit about my son. In describing the trading style he is gravitating toward, I mention that high volume is one of the things he looks for in trading setups.
That is quite interesting because one of the things I did at Lehman when I was short on information was to filter for European stocks that had unusually large volume. Then I went through all the charts of those stocks to see if any were making interesting bottoms. I would then call my contacts and ask them what they knew about those specific stocks. That's how I started to find situations to trade. Volume is incredibly important. I have found it to be a very valuable indicator.
And still do?
Yes. If a stock has been bombed out and there is a sudden jump in volume, it doesn't mean you should buy it straight away because it can go quiet again. But clearly somebody is there beginning to buy. Then you watch for signs that the stock is resilient on down days in the market, suggesting there is an underlying buying support for the stock, and you begin to nibble away at establishing a position. Sometimes the stock will then see a day where all of a sudden it just gaps up, and you trade to catch that gap. You have to do some fundamental work to find out what is going on because you don't want to end up buying a stock that is headed for zero. Volume is just a way of identifying potentially interesting situations.
You talked earlier about advising traders on the need to call people. Can you think of examples where calling people led to information that was useful for trading?
You need to be willing to call people to get information. You need to ask the next question. You never know what you will find out that will be useful. For example, there was a merger deal that had to be approved by the FCC, and nothing was happening. In the meantime, the spread kept widening and widening, and we were getting more concerned about the position. We kept calling the FCC over and over again until one time, by luck, we got the secretary of one of the commissioners who said, "Oh, that... it's on his desk ready to be signed, but he is away fishing this week." Another time, we were on the phone with a banker regarding the funding for a deal. I kept asking him a question I knew he couldn't answer. I asked the same question in 10 different ways, knowing full well that he couldn't tell me whether the funding was done or not. After the call, I said, "Sell it now." There were so many things that would have been perfectly reasonable for him to say, but he didn't.
What could he have said?
Well, he couldn't say the funding was done or that it wasn't done, but he could have said that it was a work in progress or that they were confident.
What did he say?
All he said to each question was, "I can't answer that question."
If you don't make the phone call, if you don't ask the next question, you will never know. Can you give me an example of a trade that illustrates your process?
A good example is our trade in fiat in 2003. We made 20% in a month on that single transaction. At the time, the broad market was rallying sharply in a rebound from the preceding bear market. Fiat had a big rights issue. At the same time, Deutsche Bank had announced that they would be disposing of their industrial holdings, and Fiat was one of their positions. Rather than exercise their rights, which would increase their positions, Deutsche Bank decided to sell their rights. You had a situation where the market was going up, and while Fiat should have been going the same way, it was actually going down because of a big seller. And that seller was not driven by fundamentals, but rather by a desire to rebalance their portfolio to reduce industrial holdings. And Fiat was one of their positions. Rather than exercise their rights, which would increase their position, Deutsche Bank decided to sell their rights. You had a situation where the market was going up, and while Fiat should have been going the same way, it was actually going down because of a big seller, and that seller was not driven by fundamentals, but rather by a desire to rebalance their portfolio to reduce industrial holdings. The rights were especially cheap because of the Deutsche Bank selling. We bought the rights, which effectively gave us a cheap call. Buying the Fiat rights was a trade where everything lined up. First, the market was very strong. Second, the stock was substantially underperforming the market and its sector for two technical reasons. There was a rights issue and a large seller for technical reasons that had nothing to do with the fundamentals. Third, the rights provided you with a way to put on a large position for a small capital outlay. Fourth, because Deutsche Bank was a large seller of rights and the stock was difficult to borrow, the rights were trading below their intrinsic value.
What advice do you give to people who want to be traders?
First, they need to make sure they understand their motivation. Not everyone who says they want to be a trader really does. Trading has this macho mystique. People will say they want to be a trader and won't admit to perhaps wanting to be an analyst, even if they would be happier as an analyst. They might even make more money as an analyst because they would be better at it.
You have seen a lot of traders. What are the characteristics of traders who succeed?
They all work hard. There is a first New York trader in New Zealand who trades international equities. He can't be awake 24 hours a day, but he seems to be. Nearly all the successful traders I have known are one-trick ponies. They do one thing, and they do it very well. When they stray from that single focus, it often ends in disaster. In the hedge fund world, you will see traders who do one thing very well, make a lot of money at it, and then think, "This one thing is rather boring. I can do other things because I am a genius." So they start doing other things. You had a number of great macro traders decide to branch into multi-strategy funds. It didn't work too well in 2008 when they were all exposed. One well-known macro trader wrote to his investors in 2008 that he had made them money, but it was all the other managers in the fund trading an assortment of strategies who lost all the money. Well, you hired them. You gave them all the money. We have seen that again and again in hedge funds. Managers diversify away from their expertise because they have made a lot of money and think they can do anything.
What is it about some traders that drive them away from what they do well to do things they may not do well?
I think deep down inside they know they are one-trick ponies, and that one thing could end.
But successful traders who are one-trick ponies, when that trick stops, they learn another trick.
That is exactly what happens, but some traders will change while their one trick is still working and destroy it. You need to be a bit obsessive to do the same thing 10 hours a day. People who are obsessive can become very good traders.
Are there any other traits that distinguish the successful traders?
Really good traders are also capable of changing their mind in an instant. They can be dogmatic in their opinion and then immediately change it. This market is going higher. It is absolutely going up. No, it's definitely going down. If you can't do that, you will get caught in a position and be wiped out.
Can you think of a personal experience where you completely changed your mind in an instant?
A perfect example was when Euro Disney was listed in the U.S. many years ago. It was already listed in Europe, but blue sky laws required a waiting period before it could be listed in the U.S. I built up this large position in anticipation of a burst of retail demand that would emerge when it was listed on the U.S. On the first day it became available to U.S. retail investors, we had buy orders for millions of shares. That morning, I was already very long, but I put in buy orders to get more long. The market gapped higher on the opening and started racing away on the upside. We weren't getting filled on anything because there was so little for sale. The market was moving up in gaps with very little volume. In an instant, I completely switched my orders and started selling whatever I could.
What flipped you around?
I recognized in a moment of clarity that if I had reached a fever pitch in trying to buy at any price, the moment the market turned, it would just head straight down.
And I assume it went down quickly?
It fell about 10% from that point that day, and it kept going down into the following days. Everyone had done the same thing. Everyone had come in long in anticipation of an influx of retail buy orders.
Was there a catalyst for your sudden change in sentiment?
Something clicked. I was hysterical. Before the 1987 crash, I was on a desk with experienced traders, and a rumor circulated that you had to buy this small stock called London in overseas freight. The stock had started the day at 10 pence, and I bought it at 12 pence. The stock kept going up all through the day, 13 pence, 14 pence, 15, 16 pence. The guys on the desk who hadn't bought couldn't stand the pain of not being in, and they got long. And the stock just kept going higher and higher. Finally, one trader who had not bought the stock was on the squawk box to the floor saying, "Where is it now?" The answer came back, "It's at 22. I remember these words to this day. He said, "I don't care what I have to pay, just get me in." He got filled at 23 pence. It never traded higher, and it closed the day at 12 pence. The stock eventually went to nothing. It was just a microcosm of hysteria. It might have been my recognition of the same type of hysteria in myself years later that triggered my about-face in Euro Disney. I may have even said to the broker, "Just get me stock, just get me stock." And something clicked. I've been here before, I've seen this.
What explains the extremely low volatility of your track record versus most other event-driven funds?
You have to be able to cut your position. I'll never accept anybody saying they can't cut a position.
How did you manage to completely sidestep downside volatility in 2007 and 2008?
In 2007, we got rid of anything that was directional or long-dated and put almost all our money in short-duration risk arbitrage, deals that we felt were almost certain to close and that had very wide spreads because of the market volatility. The ability of these companies to close their transactions had not been degraded by what was happening in the world. The only risk I saw was that something might happen that would cause the prime brokers to change margin requirements, which would force us to liquidate. I thought the only way that would happen would be if there was some more major market distress. To hedge against this possibility, I bought out-of-the-money puts on the S&P and sold out-of-the-money calls to pay for the puts. If the market went sideways or up, we would do very well because of our core portfolio. If the market went down suddenly, we still felt our core portfolio would hold up, and the puts would provide protection against a change in margin requirements. In 2008, the world had changed. Volatility quadrupled. I decided we should trade a fraction of what we used to trade. Most people didn't do that and got blown up.
Was there anything that triggered your cutting exposure?
We had a good month and then another very good month, and started the next month very strong. Then 2 days later, we were down for the month, and nothing had happened. I could just smell that we had to cut our positions. We took off 75% of our exposure.
So you didn't gradually cut your exposure in 2008?
Oh, no. I don't believe in this idea, we will sell 25% of our position and then think about it.
Is gut feel important to trading?
Absolutely. I have learned to trust my judgment. Gut feel is important, and you can trade off of it. But you need to have a set of rules that control your size and stop-loss points.
What are the trading rules you live by?
If you wake up thinking about a position, it's too big. Never stop asking questions. Speak to as many people as you can. Research every opposing opinion. When everything lines up, you need to swing for it because in those situations, even if you're wrong, you probably won't be wrong by that much. But if the position starts behaving in a way you don't understand, you need to cut it because then you clearly don't know what is going on. The market is telling you that you don't know.
What is your philosophy about the markets?
The market is not about facts. It's all about people's opinions and positions. Consequently, anything can be at any price, any time. Once you understand that, you realize that you need to have protective stops.
Any final words?
Your job as a trader is to make the line go from bottom left to top right. That's it. If the line goes down too much or too long, you were wrong. You can't argue that the market is wrong because it is your job to predict every move in the market. You had managers in 2008 who lost 50% and in some cases even as much as 80%. Why? Because they couldn't accept they were wrong. They kept doing the math and they kept saying they were right. They missed the point. Their math might have been right, but their job isn't to do the math. Their job is to trade what is in front of them. You had guys saying they were right, the market was wrong, and that they had billions of dollars of embedded value in their portfolio. Their job isn't to create billions of dollars of embedded value. Their job is to make the line go from bottom left to top right.